Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I think Abraham Lincoln said it best. It's better to remain silent and be thought a fool than open one's mouth and remove all doubt. But we're going to fly in the face of that advice today. Once again, welcome to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Exposing the con in conservative. Speaking of conservative, Jeff Johnson is with us. He's a staff writer for CNS News, Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com. And Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
Hey, Jeff. It sounds like you're on a cell phone there.
Unfortunately, yes. My landline is giving me problems right now.
Well, see, here's what you do. You straighten out a coat hanger and stick it in one ear and then climb up on your roof.
I never thought you would stoop to tell me to stick it in my ear.
Well, other places occurred to me, but, you know, Jeff, thanks for coming on the program with us today.
I am glad to be here, Tom. I always enjoy talking with you.
Over at CNSNews.com, Randy Hall wrote this piece about basically attacking Bernie Sanders for pointing out the fact that right-wing media dominates the American media scene, right-wing think tanks dominate the American think tank scene. And you take issue with this?
Well, actually, Randy's not attacking Representative Sanders. He's reporting what Representative Sanders said. However, Tim Carney with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is a free market or conservative organization,
well-funded by ExxonMobil.
Oh, okay. And Michael Harrison, the publisher of Talkers Magazine, also disagree with some of what Representative Sanders said, although not all of it. Obviously, there is more conservative talk radio out there than there is liberal or progressive talk radio, although that's changing. Shows like yours, networks like Air America, have brought more of the progressive voice to the airwaves. There also is a lot of liberal or progressive talk available not only on National Public Radio, but also on PRI, Public Radio International, and Pacifica Radio. So that is changing. I think the contention really that that Tim Carney and Michael Harrison have with what Representative Sanders is saying is that there's some kind of conspiracy to keep progressive ideas from the public.
Well, actually, what Carney said, in quoting from the article here, he says, it's fine for the congressman to worry about corporate ownership of the media, but it's dishonest of him to equate corporate with right-wing. And yet the right-wing agenda, the core of the right-wing agenda, is the corporatist agenda. I mean, you had General Electric throwing Phil Donahue off the air because on MSNBC, the most profitable show they had on that network, the most watched show they had on that network, throwing him off the air because he was speaking out against the United States invading Iraq, an event which turned out to be tremendously profitable for General Electric, the company that owns MSNBC, which is a defense contractor.
Well, and that's a set of facts and circumstances that your listeners have to evaluate and that the viewers of MSNBC have to evaluate and decide whether or not they want to continue to support that business. And that is exactly Sanders is calling.
But if those are the only shows that are on, the viewers really don't have those choices. I mean, please name for me one serious liberal who has a major platform on even cable television.
Let's see.
I mean, the closest you can get is Keith Olbermann, who's mostly
actually
doing a news show.
It would be easier for me to name the networks that have overwhelmingly liberal or progressive biases in their news programming.
But no, my point, nonsense, first of all. But my point is, you look at CNN, you've got Glenn Beck on there, you've got, you know, even when they bring a Democrat on, it's a wishy-washy or a weak Democrat. You've got MSNBC with Joe Scarborough on and Chris Matthews. I mean, it's basically all conservatives all the time. And if it's not conservatives, then it's white girl missing in Aruba. What's, you know, where are the progressive voices? Where is the Phil Donahue out there?
Well, I think the one that comes to mind, probably because he's the most well-known, at least on television, is the guy who's typically referred to as the token conservative of Fox News Channel, Alan Colmes.
And, so all you're able to come up with is one guy who, for 1 hour, one night a week, gets beat up badly. In fact, the show...
I can hit the list for you here if you want me to. Now, I don't have this is actually something that I found after linking from your website. You've got the Mark Riley Show, Air America in the Morning, Rachel, is it Maddow, Doug Basham, Alex Bennett, Bottom Line with Leon Gray, Liz Brown, Peter Collins, Alan Combs, I already mentioned, Christine Kraft.
None of these folks are on network television. None of these folks are on cable television.
Well, why?
I mean, I'm saying that it's because for the exact same reason that GE pulled the plug on Phil Donahue, that they don't want truly progressive voices represented, because truly progressive voices. Let me finish the sentence here, Jeff, because it's really an important point I'm trying to make, and I'd like you to address that, because truly progressive voices challenge corporate power, particularly monopolistic corporate power in the United States, and that's something that the networks will not tolerate because they're part of giant monopolies.
You said that Phil Donahue's program was the most profitable on MSNBC. Did it continue to be the most profitable on MSNBC after he started the things that you were saying that you claim got him taken off the air?
Yes, it was on the day they pulled the plug.
Really? It continued to be for future ad buys?
Absolutely. NBC doesn't dispute this. I mean, they were very embarrassed when the memo came out months after Phil Donahue was fired, that the reason that he was fired was because of his opposition to the war in Iraq.
Well, see, it's interesting to me, and again, obviously I wasn't involved in that decision, and obviously you have more details about it than I did, but it's interesting to me that a corporation which exists for the purpose of making money would make a decision that would cost it money because of politics.
Could it be because that corporation stands to make billions of dollars if there's a war with their defense industry division, but they only make hundreds of thousands or a few million on their television division if Phil Donahue stays on the air?
So they made the decision that was in the best interest of their stockholders.
That's right. That's right. And that's my point, and that was Bernie Sanders' point, is that we should go back to the way it was in the United States for a long, long time, where if you want to be a media company, that's great, but that's all you can be.
Well, I'll tell you what, there are a lot of people who agree with that, and it doesn't have anything to do with politics. There are a lot of people who, for instance, look at, can I name a major broadcast company without getting you in too much trouble?
There are a lot of people
who look at Clear Channel Radio, a corporation that owns thousands of radio stations, or actually, I guess, about 1,200 radio stations in the United States, and blame them for a lack of diversity in music formats and music programming because they look at the bottom line, not regional differences in taste in music and things of that nature. But there's a simple way to combat this, and it doesn't have anything to do with Bernie Sanders or the government. It has to do with what you do. You apparently at some point in time decided that the ideas and beliefs that you hold were not being promoted, that people were not hearing your side of the argument in specific issues, and you started writing books and writing columns, and you got a newspaper show. And by the way, I saw your ratings. Congratulations on beating Rush Limbaugh in a local market there. Was that in Portland?
No, it's in Seattle, 14th largest media.
Congratulations
in the
on that. But you have proven that the solution to this is not government intervention, but individual initiative.
Right, and the problem that I think progressive media is facing, and broadly, is the possibility. And it's not so much happening on radio, because radio is still a very competitive medium. And frankly, I don't see Clear Channel quite as the Death Star in this. And in fact, Clear Channel is probably the largest syndicator of Air America Radio right now. But in television network in particular, you have these large conglomerates that aren't just media companies. They're primarily defense contractors, or they're primarily entertainment companies, or they're primarily publishing companies, or they have their fingers in 100 different pies.
They're primarily money making machines.
That's right. And I have a real problem with that. And when you look at major media news, major news organizations and their the think tanks that they're quoting, for example, in the year 1998, 1999, the last year that there's statistics for where anybody actually did a survey on this, 8,014 major news stories that quoted think tanks. Of those 8,014 think tanks that were quoted, 8,000 of them right-wing think tanks.
According to whom?
This is according to Fairness and Accuracy in Media. which I know that you would say is a liberal organization.
Just as an example, do they classify the Cato Institute as a conservative or right-wing organization?
I don't know.
Okay,
I don't know.
I'm guessing they probably do, but Cato's libertarian. They're not conservative.
Right. I would say that they're to the right of the conservatives. In many regards. And again, you look at unpublicized donations to the three conservative think tanks which shaped U.S. public opinion by serving as the primary sources in more than 8,000 major media stories, over $129 million. But by the way, I had my numbers wrong. It was 1,632 of those think tank citations were liberal, 8,014 were conservative. But that's my point, Jeff Johnson. And so anyhow, I guess we have to leave it at that. But Jeff Johnson, CNS News, cybercastnewsservice.com, cnsnews.com. Jeff, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Tom.
Interesting conversation. 9:16, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The far right, see how they run, see how they run. They finance their campaigns by illegal means. They win their elections with voting machines. They then go to Congress and start causing things. It's the far right.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up on today's program, by the way, Heather Vokush is going to be here with us after the break at the bottom of the hour. She is live in Vienna, Austria. Let us know what the Austrians think about George W. Bush. He, of course, is in Austria right now. In fact, he just made a rather absurd statement on Viennese TV. Here he is.
So my question to you is, why do you think that you failed so badly to convince Europeans to win their heads and hearts and minds? Thank you.
Well, I thought it was absurd for people to think that we're more dangerous than Iran. For Europe, September the 11th was a moment. For us, it was a change of thinking. I don't govern by polls. You know, I just do what I think is right.
This is soundbite after soundbite.
I believe in the universality of freedom. Some don't. Some people say it's okay to condemn people to tyranny. I don't believe it's okay to condemn people to tyranny.
So, George W. Bush groping about for, let's see, what good piece from that speech can I use here, and what good what can I use here, and what can I use there, and so anyhow, Heather is going to be with us in the next half hour telling us about what the folks in Vienna think about Bush. Jeffrey Feldman will be here in our second hour with frameshopisopen.com, the new frame that the Republicans are using. Alert us to that. Larry Scott from VA Watchdog is going to drop by in our third hour with some news about the vets and the theft of vet records and, you know, that whole thing. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, apropos of our previous guest.
Yeah, but quickly, I want you to just play with Bush. Again, conflating 9/11 and Iraq. The reporter should have said, no, Europeans are in Afghanistan regarding 9/11. I asked you about Iraq. Different, unrelated deal.
Yeah, the problem is that a reporter interrupting Bush to correct him is something that just doesn't happen, even in Europe.
Right.
I mean, it did have that. There was that one time, that one reporter, that Irish reporter, gave him a hard time, and she was toast. I mean, she was absolute toast. She got fired from her, as I recall, she got fired, even fired from her company. The blowback was so severe from the White House.
Even in Ireland?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, because they, you know, the company wanted to do an interview with Laura, and Laura said, no, I'm not going to do it, and all of a sudden they got froze out. And I mean, you know, the Bush administration punishes. They're
Maybe.
Very, very good at punishing.
Scary.
Anyhow, your point you're
making. Yeah, your guest said NPR, and they all the cons do this. NPR is liberal, and we know it's not liberal, and it's not NPR's fault that often the facts have a liberal bias. An example is when a conservative says, creationism is science, and the NPR host says, wait a minute, no, it isn't. It's you know, myth. That's not a liberal bias. That's just stating a fact.
Well, actually, what amazes me, I'm starting to refer to it as National Republican Radio. This morning, for example, They interviewed Bush's outgoing speechwriter, the guy who's written all his speeches for the last 7 years, and it was totally softball questions. You know, how does your faith and the president's faith influence your thinking on, you know? And instead of saying, how could, you know, if you guys claim that you're such men of faith, because that's what most of the interview was about, was how religious this guy is,
right?
Then why did you lie a nation into something that has led to the death of over 100,000 people? And, you know, that question never got asked. None of the hard questions about lies, and it didn't have to be asked with that hard an edge to it. I mean, it could simply be asked, you know, how do you justify writing a speech about uranium that, you know, doesn't exist? Or
they've been working the ref so long that it's browbeated them. They're intimidated to be fair.
Yeah, and then they, you know, threaten to cut their funding, and so you've got NPR and all the Corporation for Public Broadcasting just running scared. And, you know, I remember back, 15, 20 years ago, they did the big investigative story on ADM, Archer Daniels Midland, that led to ADM being busted for price fixing and having to pay a multi-hundred-million-dollar fine, as I recall, $300 million fine. All of a sudden, ADM is sponsoring NPR, and all of a sudden, NPR isn't doing those kind of stories anymore. It's just like on Meet the Press last weekend. You know, it was a health insurance ad followed by a drug company ad followed by an oil company ad, and then they got the three oil company executives on there, it's anyhow, don't get me started. Tom, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Mark in Trenton, New Jersey. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind? We have about a minute left.
Hey, Tom, the guy you had on before this last caller, that reasonable sounding Republican.
Yeah.
And he sounded very much like a reasonable sounding Republican that called in another show yesterday. I've noticed the last few days that we've left-wing talk shows have noticed a big uptick in their right-wing callers. And this guy sounds exactly like the guy who called Lynn Sanders yesterday, claiming to be a Iraq veteran.
Interesting. Well, you know, it's entirely possible, in fact, probable, that the right wing is manning the phone banks and trying to get into progressive talk radio. I actually encourage them to call into here. And in fact, in the case of the fellow that we had on just a few minutes ago, we actually solicit us. I mean, you know, they send out all the lists of people who want to be on the radio, and they're doing all the right wing talk shows. So I figured, hey, we'll put them on a left wing talk show and we'll try and take them apart. And I think it's
pretty funny that all of a sudden, like right after Carl gets not indicted, that all of a sudden this stuff starts happening.
Yeah, it is. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour after the break, our European correspondent Heather Vokush will be with us from Vienna, Austria, about George W. Bush and his visit there. That and more truth and common sense in broadcasting right here on the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartmann.
I'm back here on the boat. I can hear the engines roar. Everybody's got to pay. Some people got to pay more.
Hey, Alan Van Morrison, welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Heather Vokush is on the line with us. Her website, Heather Vokush, that's spelled WOKOUSCH.com. Heather, one of my favorite progressive writers. She lives in and is reporting today from Vienna, Austria. Heather, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Great to have you here. It was nice to meet you, by the way, at the Take Back America conference.
Pleasure that was. Yeah, thank you. Great.
First, we've corresponded. You've been on the program a number of times. I've been reading your stuff for years. It was the first time to actually, you know, say hi. George W. Bush is in Vienna today. We're getting news reports here that 1,000 people are protesting, 10,000 people are protesting. It's all over the map. What's going on there?
Well, it's such a mess. I can't even begin to describe it. It really, really is quite unprecedented. He's here for this U.S.-EU summit, and they're about to talk about a number of issues, but including the fact that he wants $13 billion for Iraq, and he wants the EU to be very hardline on Iran. And so this immediately touches on issues that are very sensitive to Europeans, because there's no support for the occupation of Iraq, you know, and Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and what have you. And so he really faces a lot of negativity, you could say, on that side. But there's a second point, and that's just in the amazing and completely over-the-top security arrangements he has had in this less than a day that he's going to be here that has really, really alienated people to him and kind of been very shocking, I should say.
For example, now, first of all, I should let our listeners know, you live in Austria, you've lived in Austria for years, right?
That's right. I've been here for about 8 years, and I can tell you I've never seen anything like this.
And you speak fluent German.
Should be.
Yeah. So you know, you're talking to the folks who live there. You know what's going on now. So the
and my husband is Austrian, and so I should say, and I follow the news. The interesting thing is, I mean, the city has heads of state coming in every single week because a UN base is here, and so it really is nothing new. But for example, just to give you some shocking numbers, 3,000 security people, European security people, were necessary to protect Bush, and now this is Bush, Laura, and Condi, and their entourage. This is, you know, three people in their entourage. They needed 3,000 EU security people, and then Bush apparently brought 1,000 other, you know, of U.S. security people.
1,000?
Yes, so you have 4,000 of these security people running around. The Austrian side, only the EU side, they had to shell out an estimated $1.26 million only for this time that he's here. Now, just to give you an idea of things that people are kind of laughing about, he also, as part of his entourage, it includes, and all of this has been reported in the Austrian media, I should say, his entourage includes special doctors, special ambulances, and even blood flown in case he has issues. And the car that he drove from the airport to his hotel in, I should mention this was a 60-car convoy, 60 cars. His car was flown in because it's his favorite car. It's a Cadillac, and it's built, you know, like a tank, and this is the car that took him. I just couldn't help but think of the irony. You know, our poor troops in Iraq don't even have proper armor for their car, and he has his car flown in to just drive him from the airport. And so these are some of the things that people are really kind of making fun about.
Now, I would think, though, that Austrians and Europeans, but Austrians in particular, wouldn't think it's so odd that a current head of state is showing up. You just hosted a conference a month or so ago where you had something like 65 heads of state, Chavez and Morales and a whole bunch of other folks showing up there for a big economic summit.
That's exactly right. And certainly they don't think it's weird that somebody's showing up because, you know, as I said, they do this every single week. You've got Putin here, you've got Blair. I mean, it's normal that heads of state come. But the amount of security and just the kind of strangeness around his visit is absolutely unprecedented, these 4,000 security personnel. And I should say that the city is just blocked off. You can't commute in the normal way.
So this didn't happen when you had 65 heads of state all there at the same time a month or so ago?
Oh, that was fantastic. I mean, that didn't happen at all. You could move quite easily. And the best thing was that the highlight was that Chavez and Morales ended up drinking, one would say, many beers at this lovely little pub. You know, and they were just right out there in the open.
In town.
And everybody talked about it. And clearly there's a very different approach here.
Yeah.
And that's the second point. First is his policies, but second is the way that he has chosen to come here is a bit unprecedented. Now, I should say he's the first U.S. president to visit Austria in 27 years. So this is really, it's an honor, you know, but I don't see people treating it as such.
Yeah, you half expect, I mean, it's almost like the emperor has showed up. You know, it's the Death Star. You expect there to be some guy in the background going,
"You don't know the power of the dark side."
It's like, the empire is here, right? It has shown up. It's coming.
I should say so. And you know something your listeners might find humorous is that who else is here? Well, Cindy Sheehan is here. And she's the big rock star. She has led the demonstration this morning that had an estimated 5,000 students. And she's all over the place. And she's got her picture every place. They love her. And she has no protection.
That's marvelous. Now, what are the we're talking with Heather Vokush. Heather, VOKOUSCH.com, her website, if you want to read her writing. She's a brilliant observer of the international scene. And Heather, I'm curious, what's the average Austrian's take on George W. Bush?
Well, what's interesting for me is we have to put Austrians into context. This is a very refined culture and very accepting and very diplomatic by nature. And so it really is not common for people to be highly critical of any kind of world leader, at least not in my experience. And I have not found anybody. The only reactions I have seen, you know, in people that I've talked to have been extremely negative. And this morning I had just the most devastating experience. I went to my little local mom and pop store. I live out in the countryside. And I had four people come up to me in these very worried tones, and two of them were elderly. They lived through World War II. They lived through Hitler. And all of three came up to me and they said, why is he here? You know, what is he doing here? And more disturbing is that a few of them said, I don't feel comfortable with this man. He reminds me of Hitler. And I can say this was devastating to me. I would never, I find that so inflammatory to compare anybody to Hitler. I would never do that. And in Austria, it's absolutely taboo. People don't mention his name in casual conversations.
Yeah, I was going to say, I lived in Germany for a year, and I've been visiting Germany 2-3 times a year for the last 25 years, and I've been in Vienna many times, and people just don't say the H word out loud. I mean, it's just...
Exactly. So, I mean, I was stunned, and I said, you know, I'm sorry, but what do you mean? And there was no, it wasn't this attacking emotion. It was, well, you know, because I remember back then. And what bothers me about this guy, and I'm paraphrasing, is that, one, he seems to, by this huge security personnel and all of this, he seems to enjoy a kind of cult of personality. And it seems the only thing that he understands how to do is war. And I'm paraphrasing what I heard from these elderly people today. And they said, and that's what really worries us, because that's what reminds us of how it was in the past. And so I found that just devastating, quite frankly.
Hmm. Now, Heather, what do you expect is going to be the response of, is this the European Union that Bush is meeting with, or is it just the leaders of Austria?
No, Austria has the head of the EU right now, and so that's the only reason he happens to be in Austria. So he actually, you know, for example, that Latin American summit, all of the European heads were here. But this time there's only the EU Commission President Barroso, the Foreign Affairs guy Solana, and the EU Council President. It's only these three.
And
now the bottom line, what Bush wants is this money for Iraq, and he also wants a commitment on Iran. What's interesting, of course, is that right during this time, you know, North Korea announces that it wants to have its first long-range missile test.
Right.
And so that has been the real wild card here, because it puts the states in this very uncomfortable position, you know, about what to do. The interesting thing is what the EU wants is energy security. You know, they're very worried about Russia, you know, because they cut off the oil to the EU last year, and they want
right.
the states to support them. And so what happened is the states is actively saying that, but what hasn't been reported so much, and is kind of funny, he was supposed to visit Ukraine right after this, but at the last minute they changed it, and instead Bush will be going to Budapest, Hungary tonight. And what many commentators have said is, well, he doesn't want to irk Russia, because Russia has issues with the Ukraine.
Yeah, well, this could go beyond irking Russia. I mean, Putin, Cheney was in Putin's face a while back, and Putin blew back. I mean, you know, he just pushed right back.
And also we got the G8 summit there in July. And so,
yeah.
And Bush needs Putin's support for Iraq and Iran. And so there's tough talk, but I don't really know what's going to come of it, quite frankly. But expectations are not high.
Interesting. But there may be a deal made. You, the United States, you help us secure oil supplies from the Middle East, and we will support your efforts in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. It would appear that that's kind of what they're talking about. And the big carrot that's being held up is Guantanamo. Bush today said, and I quote, I'd like to end Guantanamo. I'd like it to be over with. And many people, and end quote, and many people thought, oh, my goodness, that's a clear sign. But
yeah.
A lot of people are skeptical.
End the concentration camp. What he'll do is he'll just ship them to Bagram in Afghanistan, which is even worse. I mean, well, who knows? Heather Vokush, Vokush.com. Heather Vokush.com, the website. Heather, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds
that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand.
We cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds.
Wake up and shake it up, America.
From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea.
And welcome back. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con and conservative Rush Limbaugh cynically exploiting the deaths of two U.S. soldiers, the gruesome beheadings and mutilation. Rush Limbaugh cynically exploiting the deaths of these two young men by coming up with lies about liberal blogs. Now, you know that if Limbaugh found even one liberal blog out there that said something to the effect of, oh, these guys got what they deserved, that he would be publicizing the name of that blog so that holy hell could descend upon them from the conservative right. There is nobody on the left who is saying anything to that effect, myself included. These were brave young men, and the way that they were murdered is horrific and absolutely unjustifiable in any context. And the people who did it should be found and should be punished in the most severe fashion possible. But that's not what Limbaugh has to say about what the rest of America has to say. The half of America who call themselves liberal. Limbaugh thinks, well, I'll let you. Here's in his own words.
I got an email here. Rush, now that two of our own have been tortured and murdered by the terrorists in Iraq, will the left say that they deserved it? I am so sick of our cut-and-run liberals. Keep up your great work. I got to tell you, I perused the liberal kook blogs today, and they are happy that these two soldiers got tortured. They're saying good riddance. Hope Rumsfeld and whoever sleep well tonight.
Can you believe that? I mean, this is such a tragedy that a nationally syndicated talk show host with a high profile would be using the deaths of these two young men, these two brave young men, would be using their deaths to try to score political points and try to trash at least half of America that simply believes in the traditional liberal values of we're all in this together. We really do need a decent minimum wage. We really should have a national health care program. We want to have good schools. We want our cops to be paid a decent wage and our firefighters. The traditional liberal values that this country was founded on, that Limbaugh would use the deaths of these two young men to trash the foundations of America. Certainly to do everything that he can to roll back the New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal, Roosevelt's idea that, hey, we are all in this together. We are one America. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. No. Bush and Limbaugh, they want us to fear everything, so that they can undo Roosevelt's legacy.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Tragically. Ken in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Ken, welcome to the program. You are live and on the air, Ken. Yep.
Oh.
Ken, I'm gonna come back to you here. You got to be listening to your phone, not your radio. Bob in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
Good. I heard you talking earlier about the journalist from the Irish Times.
Yeah.
I just so happened to be in Dublin last October when that there was a big article written about her interview with Bush and how Bush basically kept smirking at her, giving her rotten looks because she actually stood up to him. She's one of the few journalists, maybe the only one, that has really leveled him.
Yes, and in fact, I used to have the audio clip of it. I probably do someplace around here. Yes, she did a good job. Do you know what her ultimate fate was?
You know, I don't.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But she was a hero among the Irish, I can tell you that.
She sure was. And you know what? I was telling your call screener, my brother and I were sitting in a pub in Dublin, and we were watching Ireland was playing, I think it was Switzerland, in one of the things to get into the World Cup. And the guy looked at us and he said, oh, American, are you? And we said, yes. And he said, you didn't vote for George Bush, did you? And we said, absolutely not. He said, fine, I'll buy you gents a couple pints. And
you
your last guest, did she say that Bush was not staying the night in Austria?
I don't recall if she did or not.
Because if she did, I was wondering if that had to do with Mick Jagger and the Stones not giving up their room for him.
Oh, that's interesting. That's right.
If I remember, I think I read that somewhere.
Yeah, no, that did happen. And this must be the trip that was for. Well, that's interesting.
Right.
Thanks, Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. In fact, I had a similar experience a couple of years ago. 2 years ago, I believe it was, I was invited to Oxford University to speak about my book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And it was, I mean, it's a big honor to be invited to be a speaker at Oxford University. And, you know, I get in there, and I'm in this giant hall, and there's a couple hundred students and a bunch of faculty. And afterwards, they had a whole reception for me and all this kind of junk. And I get up to start speaking. I get introduced, and I get up to start speaking, and I'm being heckled immediately. It's like prime minister's questions, right? I'm right off the bat, some student in the front row, what do you think of Bush? And it's like, you know, and the people in the audience, yeah, what about Bush? And I'm like, I'm here to talk about corporate prison. So I said, I didn't vote for Bush. Bush does not represent my worldview or my perspectives. And I got a standing ovation. And then they all sat down and listened to me, you know, rant for an hour and a half about corporate personhood. I mean, it was pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. It's just, we need to be calling out Bush on the absolute crimes. I lack a better word. You know, Heather was talking about how Europe is very concerned about the concentration camps that were operating in Guantanamo Bay. This is wrong that the United States has concentration camps. It's wrong that we're holding people, that even if these folks in Guantanamo Bay are real prisoners or are real war criminals, we should be holding trials for them like we did the Nazis after World War II. Give people a fair trial and show the world that America still believes in American values. But Bush doesn't believe in American values, thus the tragedy. Up next, the latest in progressive framing with Jeffrey Feldman and your calls and more right here on the Tom Hartman radio program. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense in the radical middle. Tom Hartman here, 6 minutes after the hour. Jeffrey Feldman, America's framing guru, is with us. His website, frameshopisopen.com. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tom.
Great to have you with us. You have a three-part series here, three ways to gut, cut, and run on Frame Shop is Open here. Walk us through this.
Well, there's been this attack from the Republicans against just about anyone who questions the policy in Iraq, what the Republicans call the war in Iraq, but what most Americans see as an occupation in Iraq. And there's been a lot of concern amongst Democrats on how to confront this particular attack. So I take this on slowly on the site today, going at it over a few different posts. But initially, pointing out the fact that cut and run, which is supposed to be, or it seems to be, an attack on Democrats as being, I don't know, cowardly or unwilling to fight enemies of the United States. In fact, it's just a snow job, really. I mean, it's a bait and switch. It's an attempt every time there's a critique of what's going on in Iraq for the Republicans to fight back by saying that no matter how bad things are getting, everything is really the Democrats' fault. It's been going on for a while, this attack. I went back and I found an article by Tony Snow that was published in late 2005, in which the title of the article was The Cut and Run Crowd. So this is a tried and true attempt by the Republicans to really just change the subject and focus all attention on the Democrats.
So how should the Democrats gut, cut, and run?
Well, Well, initially, I think that everyone needs to see that when we're talking about Iraq, we're talking about national security. The frame here is not the danger that the Democratic Party poses to the United States. That is what the Republicans would like everyone to discuss, because we're heading into an election year, and they're trying to show that there's some type of clear choice between the Democrats and the Republicans. They tried this in the past two elections with some success, and so they're reverting to form. What we need to do, what Democrats, what Americans who are interested in national security need to do, is change the subject back to what really is the threat to the United States. When Republicans say cut and run, people should respond by talking about Al-Qaeda. Well, we've had a war that's been going on, a policy that's been going on for a number of years, and one of the major things that it's accomplished is that it's created a smarter, more effective, and harder to catch Al-Qaeda. So initially we need to change the subject back to that.
In fact, in a very real way, Al-Qaeda has been tremendously strengthened by the policies of the Bush administration.
It's incredible. In this last incident, Zarqawi was captured, was killed, and the Bush administration talked about the importance of that. Within hours, there was a new leader appointed to the head of Al-Qaeda, and they conducted an operation abducting some American soldiers and tragically killing them. The reports are that they were actually beheaded, left on the side of a road, and surrounded by explosive devices, all while American forces are watching overhead with airplanes and so forth. So this is, I mean, it's really striking how far the Al-Qaeda organization has managed to come through these 4 years.
Are you certain that it was Al-Qaeda that did this, Jeffrey, or was this more of the local Iraqis who don't want their country occupied, what we refer to as the insurgency?
I'm not certain. I'm following a report that I heard on PBS a few days ago, in which there was some speculation that it was Al-Qaeda.
Because I know Al-Qaeda is claiming credit for it, and you would expect that. They want to claim credit for everything. And just like, you know, whenever it used to be, whenever a bomb would go off in Israel, you'd have five different organizations going, that was our guy. No, that was our guy. No, it was our guy. And so you would expect them to claim credit for it. And the Bush administration blamed Al-Qaeda, and you would expect them to blame Al-Qaeda because they want there to be a boogeyman. Even if there's not, they want to divert the attention of Americans away from the fact that, according to Rumsfeld's own Pentagon, 95%, you know, 19 out of 20 attacks on Americans are not coming from Al-Qaeda or from foreign fighters or jihadists or Muslim extremists or, you know, fill in the blank. They're coming from local Iraqis who are simply sick and tired of having us in their country.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. And, you know, the fact that the 4 years of this policy have created this very nimble opposition, where initially, it was not there, should be, that to remind, you know, listeners of that particular fact is a great way to reframe this issue.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that we have tremendously strengthened Al-Qaeda around the world. I mean, certainly, you know, in Iraq, prior to our invasion of Iraq, you had basically this one guy, Zarqawi, up in the north, protected by us in the no-fly zone. Bush had three opportunities to take him out, chose not to do it three different times. Once a week before the invasion of Iraq, chose not to do it then, now the documents show, because that would have eliminated his rationale for war. And because now, you know, then he could say, well, there's an Al-Qaeda guy there. Although there are Al-Qaeda guys pretty much all over the world. But now, you know, now there's kids walking around downtown Jakarta, Indonesia with Osama bin Laden t-shirts on, thinking it's cool.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it really is unbelievable. And that's why, in terms of this cut-and-run attack against the Democrats, I mean, it's important to focus on the bigger issue, which is national security. And the idea that Democrats want to withdraw troops is incredibly misleading. You know, what the Democrats are suggesting is that it's important for the U.S. military to retake the high ground in this particular struggle, the struggle for national security. And that means not leaving resources and lives to be wasted in the middle of Iraq, but coming up with a leaner and a smarter strategy.
Yeah, so this is part one of the three ways to gut, cut, and run?
Yeah, that's part. You know, part one is realizing that the issue is being framed, and then part two is changing the subject to, you know, Al-Qaeda or the insurgency, and then part three is talking about getting leaner and getting smarter.
Which seems like just a very reasonable thing to do. You, over at frameshopisopen.com, Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief there, you have an excellent article about net neutrality and the dumb pipe blog ads.
Yeah, this is this amazing ad that popped up last week on a lot of progressive blogs, and it was being it was an ad that was purchased through a blog ad system, which feeds into a lot of smaller blogs out on the internet, and it looks very hip. It looks like it would be an ad that would be promoting net neutrality, which is this effort to stop this act, which is up before Congress, which would essentially give control of the internet to large media firms, enabling them to create this two-tiered system with very, very questionable end results. And there was a lot of concern that this ad would be duping or fooling the progressive public. So I wrote about this ad and talked about how it is an attempt by the right to essentially promote their side of this debate using the very progressive net roots that are arguing against it.
New Tech, what is this, blog ads? Is that who they're buying it through?
They're buying it through blog ads.
Yeah, because I'm seeing it on your website.
It's up on the website, and I argue that, you know, frame shop readers like to read Republican propaganda and see how it works and take it apart. So I left it up there. It'll probably come down in the next couple of days and give people a chance to look at it and see how it works.
Yeah, we have a blog ads slot on our website as well. It'll probably show up there at some point.
Yeah.
Amazing. Communicating the progressive vision. You gave a talk at the Daily Kos, or the yearly Kos convention in Vegas.
That was an amazing, amazing experience. I was very fortunate to have a panel that included George Lakoff, kind of a great professor of framing out of Berkeley, a couple of authors, John Derich, Jim Jarrett, John Javna, and then Justin Krebs, who leads an organization here in New York called Drinking Liberally. And we had an hour-long discussion about various ways that it's possible to get the progressive message out there. It was really well attended. And we even broadcast on C-SPAN. We got a lot of great response. The yearly
Kos
event was fantastic, really fantastic.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about it. What would you suggest are the main ways to get the progressive message out there, Jeffrey Feldman?
Well, the key issue that came out of our panel was the importance of creating experiences where people have the opportunity to get out there and to communicate with each other and to find other people. It wasn't just about generating slogans. It was about talking to people about how to deal with right-wing radio, for example. It was about giving people the tools to meet each other over a drink, you know, every single week. It was about seeing the bigger, deeper issues and really using tools where the rubber hits the road. I think that the big change that's unfolded over the past year with regard to communications is that people no longer look to a centralized single slogan, but see themselves as picking up tools, whatever those tools may be, whether it's framing or networking, and then using those as a starting point to affect their own change in the debate.
And the range of tools would be?
Well, the range of tools ranging from a Lakoffian approach to framing, to workshopping propaganda that one sees in the newspaper, to having viewer groups in order to respond to what one sees on the television, to coming up with creative ways to get a protest message out. All these different things are tools that people have been using over the past year, and there's a lot more initiative, a lot more organizing in this direction, creating places for people to come together, not just slogans.
Yeah, and one of those places is frameshopisopen.com. The editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Feldman. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour after the break. A few reasons Bush shouldn't make it to 2008. Tom Hartman, I'll be back with you in just a few moments, exposing the con in conservative.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lord have mercy on the blue collar man. I'm a blue-collar man.
And welcome back. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. Victoria Jones with us from Washington, D.C. Our senior cat goes to the vet correspondent.
That's correct. Yes, that was the major event of the day. Forget about what other news is taking place. When the cat has to go to the vet, you've got him. You know.
You've got, yeah, we have three of them. And,
exactly.
You've got
to,
seem
get
to be acquiring
the carrier,
a fourth.
Get them there and get them out of the carrier at the other end.
Yeah, what kind of cat do you have?
I have two. I have a long-haired blue and cream and a short-haired orange tabby.
Amazing. We have a We have a short-haired orange tabby who likes to eat people. But I digress.
Yes, indeed. Yes, back to the less important, but
the vitals. Yeah, what's
vital
going on in Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
We had a report in the last hour, Victoria Jones, from Heather Vokush in Vienna, Austria. And she said that the average Austrian is absolutely horrified by George W. Bush showing up there. There's 10,000 people in the streets. She said she hasn't heard. She's lived there for 8 years. She's married to an Austrian. She's a reporter from the United States. And she hasn't heard the H word used in Austria in years, the Hitler word. It's just you don't do it. It's a word you don't use in polite company. This morning in the local supermarket, she had four people go out of their way to come up to her as an American and say specifically that George Bush reminded them of Hitler. Three of them.
Whoa.
Two of them, she said, were women in their 80s who remembered the Hitler time.
No!
Yes.
That's embarrassing.
I know. It's incredible. So anyhow, what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, as I try and blanch my face after the redness of that, well, the Senate voted down raising the minimum wage.
They voted it down. Just plain. I was expecting a poison pill.
No, they actually refused to raise it. They voted it down by 52 to 46.
So this was a party-line vote. The Republicans opposed, the Democrats in favor.
That's exactly right. Senator Ted Kennedy saying the obvious. I don't think the Republicans get it, he said.
You know, if we were to match the minimum wage of 1968 in today's dollars, it would be $9.31.
Wow. Well, all they're trying to get it up to is $7.25.
Right, which is just a little more than it was in 1950. When Harry Truman was president, it would have been, I had it here just a minute ago. Oh, it would have been $6.30 in today's dollars.
It's amazing. And now it's $5.15. And yeah. Really, I think most of us don't really believe it still is only $5.15.
Well, in a lot of states, it's not. And this is, I mean, here in Oregon, for example, it's $7.25 an hour. I think it's going to $7.50 this year. And because, you know, people in the states are saying, hey, wait a minute, enough already. And what we found is that every state that increases the minimum wage sees an increase in economic activity and an increase in general standard of living.
Then why is that argument not used effectively?
I don't know, because it's there. I mean, the statistics are absolutely undeniable. They are out there. And Ted Kennedy has quoted those statistics on the floor of the Senate. It's just that they don't get picked up by the mainstream media.
Like so much else. I mean, I was over at a friend's house last night who was repeatedly asking me why, I think I said that we said this yesterday, why isn't the mainstream media reporting that Bush only spent 5 hours in Iraq?
Right.
People are obsessed with that story over here in D.C. Why is the mainstream media covering up all this, why is the mainstream media taking Bush's side in all these stories?
Yeah, if Iraq is so much safer than Washington, D.C., as the Republican member of Congress pointed out last week on the floor of the House, why doesn't Bush stay there?
Well, very interesting.
Heather also said the people of Austria. She said last month there was a G8 meeting or some kind of meeting there, and there was like 53 or 56 world leaders who showed up, and it was no big deal. You could still travel around Austria. She said Bush brought 1,000 of his own security people. He flew in his own limousine. He flew in his own limousine because it's a Cadillac and he likes driving an American-made car, and it's armored. And she said the Austrians are looking at this and they're going, American GIs in Iraq can't get armored Humvees, but Bush flies in his own armored limousine?
1,000 security people?
And a contingent of 1,000 security people.
What did they do?
They have shut down Vienna. And even when they had all the heads of all the, Tony Blair was there, Putin was there. I mean, they had people from all over the world. Vienna didn't get shut down. In fact, the big deal was that Hugo Chavez and Morales Ecuador, were having drinking beers together in a pub in downtown Vienna, you know, right out in public and everything. It's just a night and day contrast.
It is extraordinary. The sense he must have of himself.
Well, it's like it's Imperius
Rex.
It's an
emperor, isn't it? It's an emperor.
Yes, Imperius Rex. It's downright spooky. Just a few seconds left. Other hot stories out of Washington, D.C. here?
Well, the other story, although it's in Iraq, but it is a big story, and there will be a press conference at 4 Eastern today, is the arrest of the 8 soldiers for the killing of the Iraqi man in Hamdaniya in April. Mm. This is the guy who was dragged out of his house. We talked about this and killed, and then it was made to look as though he was an insurgent. They were just out there looking for a revenge. They went out one evening looking to kill an Iraqi.
and they went out looking to kill an insurgent, couldn't find one, so they just decided to kill an Iraqi instead.
And this is demonstrated to the point where the military feels that they can actually prosecute these soldiers.
Right.
That's tragic.
Yeah.
That is tragic. It is tragic that George W. Bush has lied us into a situation where our young men and women are in these kinds of positions where they're going crazy. I mean, I don't know how else to say it.
That's the only way to say it, I think.
They're just going crazy, and it's tragic. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com, the Talk Radio News Service. Next, Alcohol Can Be a Gas with author David Bloom. You're not going to want to miss this one. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Tell him, Neil Young, welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. Tom Hartman with you. David Bloom is here in the studio with me. He's on a speaking tour coming through Portland here tonight. And he's the author of a new book. It'll actually be out this fall, titled Alcohol Can Be a Gas. He's the executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture, permaculture.com, the website. And you may think that this whole topic of alcohol as a gas, we're going to talk about ecology and this is going to be boring. This is mind-boggling stuff. David Bloom, welcome to our program.
I'm glad to be here.
Great to have you here. David, two myths. Well, let's just blow apart some of these myths. Let's start out with myth number one. And by the way, these myths were, as you probably, I don't know, did you catch the Sunday show where you had the three oil industry executives were on Meet the Press with Tim Russert?
I missed that one, but I can probably repeat what they said without ever seeing it.
Yeah, man, it was grim. And you know, one of the myths was, well, it takes more gasoline to produce alcohol as a fuel than you get in alcohol as a fuel. Myth number one.
Right. Well, that's been promoted for more than 30 years, and there's nothing at all true about that. There's only one researcher on the planet that actually makes that claim, but when the American Petroleum Institute prints press releases about that, it goes all over the planet. So basically,
they quote that one guy.
Yes,
so this is sort of like the global warming nonsense. This is they're taking it
right. There's five guys that say global warming is a theory, not a fact, and they always quote one of those guys for balance.
Right.
So the fact of the matter is, the way it gets presented is that it takes more petroleum to make alcohol than you get out in the energy of the alcohol. And first of all, that's on the surface just not true. Alcohol is primarily, as far as the planet's concerned, made from sugar cane. And when we use sugar cane to make alcohol, we get 8 units of energy out for every energy unit going in. But in the case of the energy going in, it's not even petroleum. In Brazil, where they make alcohol, they take the sugar cane fiber that's left over from crushing sugar cane to make the alcohol and burn it in boilers to produce electricity and heat for the plant and export 3/4 of the electricity to the grid. So it's not only an 8-to-1 energy output, but it's not even the one unit going in. It's not even fossil fuel. Now, in the U.S., where we're using corn.
So hang on just a second. In Brazil, it's basically an all-flex fuel nation. Brazil is no longer having to import gasoline.
No, they stopped importing gasoline quite a while ago. They've been exporting what they call the unsellable toxic waste of their oil refineries, which is gasoline, and they sell it on the world market because they don't need it.
Amazing. So you finishing up this myth that it takes more fuel to make alcohol as a fuel than there is.
Well, in the U.S., when you were using corn, there's a lot of chemical fertilizer use, which uses a lot of natural gas to produce fertilizer. But even with that, we get out about 70% more energy than we put in. But in the long term, corn is probably not the crop that we'll be making most of our alcohol from. I mean, we get 300 gallons of alcohol per acre from corn, but from many other crops, like, for instance, sugar beets, we can get well over 1,000 gallons. And when we start looking at cellulose crops, in other words, taking plant fiber and breaking that down to sugar to ferment into alcohol, we can be looking at 2,500 to 5,000 gallons per acre. Had a very tiny amount of energy.
Shrubs, trees, hemp,
all of that.
Sawgrass.
Yeah, there's a hemp association that's asking me to look at the byproduct from hemp cloth manufacturer and start converting it to alcohol. It's a research project we're on right now.
Now, myth number two that was reported by the one of the heads of the big oil companies on Russert's show, he said, well, you know, these biofuels are all well and good. He was very patronizing. They're all well and good. But they only produce about 75% of the energy. You only get about 75% of the gas mileage from biofuels that you do from gasoline. And so we really need to use gasoline if we want to, you know, get decent car. You know, it might be a little cheaper, but it produces less gas mileage.
Well, see, this is a really funny myth because it's always how you build the assumptions. Alcohol has about two-thirds the heating value of gasoline, which is one way to measure energy in a fuel. But heat in an internal combustion engine is the waste product. Work is the product that we're getting out of, you know, our car, miles per gallon. So alcohol and gasoline do not burn with the same efficiency. In fact, alcohol can burn with twice the efficiency of gasoline. So even though it starts off with less energy, the mileage can actually be superior to gasoline. And that's being proven out today with a flexible fuel car sold in Sweden right now that can run on alcohol or gasoline and gets the same mileage on both.
On either one.
Yeah.
Now, we talked earlier this morning, and you startled me by suggesting that a barrel of oil, which costs $80 right now, is worth a whole lot more than $80 to an oil company, number one. And number two, that the 25 or so gallons of gasoline that they derive from that barrel of oil is essentially a toxic waste-laden waste byproduct, that they really could be profitable even if they never made any gasoline.
That's right. The price of gasoline has nothing to do with the price of oil. You know, it's true half a barrel of oil ends up as fuel, but the other half of the barrel ends up as very valuable products, everything from pantyhose to plastics to pesticides, and those things are worth a lot of money when oil companies, you know, make things from them. And so
a barrel of oil is worth how much?
Well, basically Dow Chemical says $25,000 of products come out of one half of the barrel, and the other half of the barrel is about $250 worth of fuel. So really
$25,000.
Yes, that's
right. Barrel of oil.
From the things
the chemical industry can make from a barrel of oil.
Absolutely.
So you would think that the oil companies would be saying, stop using gasoline because we can sell the other half of the barrel of oil for $25,000. Except then you've got the waste product left over that's called gasoline, right?
Right, and this has always been the historical position of gasoline. When Rockefeller first made kerosene for lighting homes at night, he would flush the volatiles, which today would be called gasoline, into rivers to get disposed of them at night. Today, you know, they charge us to get rid of this toxic waste and put it in our cars. So it's really, you know, anything that's left over from making something valuable from oil is what goes into gasoline. Gasoline is never the same 2 days in a row.
So gasoline is a conglomeration, an agglomeration of the toxic waste byproducts from converting a barrel of oil into $25,000 worth of pesticides and nylon and these kinds of other products.
Yes, in fact, there's over 400 chemicals on any given day, and they boil from anywhere from 80 degrees to 450 degrees. So there's tar stuff and varnish and all this kind of junk that should never be in an engine because of the emissions that it puts out.
But now, they put it in gasoline because it's cheaper to put it in gasoline than to pay a toxic waste facility to dispose of it.
It would be unbelievably costly if the oil companies had to pay the true cost, not only of disposing gasoline in as a toxic waste, but what it's costing us in health costs and environmental costs. You know, the byproducts of gasoline are causing, you know, this country a huge amount of health costs. There's almost no byproducts whatsoever when you burn alcohol in a car. It burns so clean that it's probably the only thing cleaner is hydrogen, and only by a little bit. Alcohol is so clean that the inside of your engine never even sees carbon. No black, sooty stuff inside the engine.
Does this mean that my engine will last longer?
Well, historically, alcohol engines have lasted three times what they do on gasoline.
Is that why the car companies are opposed to the use of alcohol and in favor of the use of gasoline, because the engines burn up three times faster or have one-third the lifespan, so they can sell you a new car every 3 years instead of every 9 years?
You know, that might have been the case before, but right now the only growth industry that automobile companies have are flex-fuel vehicles. In other words, vehicles that can run on both alcohol and gasoline. So car companies around the world are fully embracing alcohol now, where they've opposed it for most of the history of internal combustion engines. And, for instance, in Brazil, within 3 years, they went from zero flexible fuel cars to now several companies saying they no longer make gasoline-only cars in Brazil. They make cars that can run on both gasoline and alcohol. And we actually produce them here, and we have since 94, but just not in large quantities. GM, of course, is making a big deal out of their increased production, but all the other automakers are following suit. It only costs $50 extra on the assembly line to make a car that will run on any mixture of alcohol and gasoline, from pure alcohol to pure gasoline. It's just
What is the difference? Just a carburation difference?
No, basically software. You know, alcohol needs less air than gasoline to burn. And it also is 105 octane, which means you can start the spark earlier. So you tune the car differently so that it's more like a race car. And, you know, modern fuel injection computers actually are so sophisticated that without changing anything, you can run 50% alcohol just fine. And in the Midwest, people are doing that right now, because there are about 600 stations in the Midwest where you can buy alcohol at the pump. It's called E85 for being
85% alcohol. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, basically the cost of alcohol is so much less than gasoline. People are saying, well, put a little of that in my tank. Let's see how it goes. And, you know, they're all finding that they can get away with half alcohol and half gasoline. And if you have to use premium in your SUV, which is way more expensive than regular, well,
premium is like 93 octane. Alcohol is 105 octane.
Right, and so you can buy regular for half your gas and then put alcohol in for the other half, and you got like 103 octane fuel, which makes your engine just fine. So it's a huge threat.
We just have 20 seconds left. Why don't we have alcohol all across the United States right now?
Well, you know, it's all about politics and who runs our government and how entrenched the military petroleum industrial complex is, because basically the reason why we have such a big military is because it runs on oil, and oil is there because it has such a big military to protect it. It's a long entrenched system.
And as long as they can make $25,000 on a barrel of oil manufacturing pesticides and plastics, and they have this 25 gallons of waste material called gasoline left over, they want us to keep buying the gasoline.
Well, you know, we cover all this stuff on our website at permaculture.com, and there's a great deal of information about just why and how we can go ahead and get off petroleum and get on to alcohol.
There you go. David Bloom, the website permaculture.com. His new book, it'll be out this fall, Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Check it out. David Bloom, thanks for being with us. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is supplying for we the people who can ignore them.
We shall reap what we sow, so we better sow
carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
North, south, east, west, from sea to shining sea.
And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in Little Beirut, the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Welcome back. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Carla in Clearfield, Pennsylvania. Hey, Carla, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. My question is, has anybody, you know, the Bush administration keeps claiming the economy is doing wonderfully, and I want to know if they took out the amount of money the government is spending on the Iraq war, how would our economy be doing?
It would be doing really, really bad. We are spending hundreds of billions of dollars. Well, actually, trillions of dollars. I mean, Bush has run up our national debt in his 5 years of his presidency by an additional $4 trillion. That's $4,000 billion. That's all money that has been borrowed and spent. And when you borrow and spend money, it looks like you're living large. It would be the same as if you, Carla, went out on your credit card and spent $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 a year to support a lifestyle that looked like you had an income of $500,000 a year. People would say, "Wow, that Carla, she's really doing well." That's what's going on.
Doesn't this mean that we are subsidizing our economy by going into debt then?
Yes.
Why isn't the Democrats bringing this up?
They bring it up almost every day, Carla. The mainstream media will not report it.
Well, that was, I have not heard.
Sorry about that, but in any case, no, it's, you can't, the problem is the media will not report the fact that they report it kind of in passing. You know, they don't talk about the consequences. Well, you know, Bush has raised the debt ceiling now to $9 trillion, but they don't talk about what's really going on. Cher in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Cher.
Hi. I want to say that I listen to AM 1090 all day long to everybody all the time.
It's a great station.
Huh?
It's a great station.
Oh,
yeah. Proud to be on it.
Oh, yes. Yesterday, Ed Schultz's program had somebody else on, and I forget his name, but that isn't the point. The point is who called in while he was on yesterday. Somebody called in with a great response to cut and run. And I wasn't listening very closely, but suddenly he kept saying these same sentence over and over again, and I thought, wow, that's really good. Okay, what he was saying is he was saying the response to way to go back to cut and run is cut. Bush has cut college funding and run up the deficit. Bush has cut veterans funds and run up the deficit. Bush has cut school lunch funding and run up the deficit. And he listed a whole bunch of stuff, which I really didn't get written down or remember.
Yeah, no, it's an email that's running around the blogosphere. I read part of it on the air here yesterday also. It's, yeah, you're absolutely right, and it's a good rebuttal, Cher. And you know, thank you for sharing that with us. And we all should be saying it. We all should be saying it more often, frankly. Anyway.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are.
What's going on in Iraq?
I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
The events in Iraq, summarized by Reuters, between 80 and 100 Iraqi factory workers were kidnapped today. That story is still developing. In Baghdad, gunmen kidnapped and killed Khamis al-Obaidah, one of Saddam Hussein's chief defense lawyers, dumped his bullet-ridden body in a street. In Tikrit, gunmen kidnapped three relatives of the deputy governor of Salahiddin province. In Baghdad, two people were killed and six wounded when a car bomb exploded in a crowded market in the Shiite district of Sadr City. Near Tikrit, U.S. forces arrested 12 people on Tuesday without giving further detail. In Baghdad, two people were killed and six wounded when a car... Oh, I just read that here. Baghdad, Iraqi and U.S. forces captured Nur Abu Haider al-Okabi, described as a high-level insurgent responsible for many kidnappings and killings during a raid in Baghdad's Shula district. In Baghdad, in Basra, the deputy chief of the Sunni Endowment religious organization in Basra was wounded and a roadside bomb exploded near his car on Tuesday. And also in Baghdad, gunmen killed the imam of a Sunni mosque on Monday in his house in the Shula district, the Association of Muslim Scholars said in a statement. Gunmen also killed a high school teacher in the same neighborhood, the association said. And on top of it all, you remember the mother who about a year ago invited the press in to take pictures of the arrival of the coffin of her son because the Pentagon didn't want that to happen? Nadia McCaffrey, I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. Well, this is just incredible. The mother of a soldier killed last week in Iraq. Now this is back from June 28th, 2004. That she invited the media in to disseminate images of her son's slain body. Now we have. In 2006, June 21st, 2006, a few weeks before he died, a depressed specialist, Patrick Ryan McCaffrey, called his father from Iraq and told him that he'd been fired on. And McCaffrey said his 34-year-old son, this is the one who 2 years ago, they didn't want the picture taken. Turns out he was killed. Now 2 years later, they discover he was killed by the Iraqi soldiers that he was training. And so his mother is raising a little, and his father, raising a little noise about this, as you can well imagine. We'll be back right after the news at the top of the hour. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program.
You
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. You're in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations. Should George W. Bush be impeached? This is a topic. Remember the Republicans were all at Twitter about this? They were absolutely hysterical. You go back just 4 or 5 weeks ago, the Republican, I was getting emails every single day from the RNC saying, the Democrats, the party of impeachment. I mean, they were the Republicans were actually promoting this all over TV. You had these Republicans, these cons who were going on and on and on about how, well, if the Democrats take the House and Senate, they're going to try to impeach George Bush. And they really thought that this was going to, like, scare Americans. And then apparently they did some polling. They looked around, they asked a few questions, and they discovered that when Americans were asked if Democrats take control of the House and Senate and they successfully impeach Bush and Cheney, is that going to upset you? And Americans said, no, it doesn't upset us at all. In fact, we're all in favor of it. When the Republican Party discovered that there were more Americans who were in favor of Bush being impeached than opposed to him being impeached, something, by the way, that never happened with Clinton, they dropped that thing like a hot potato. They ran from it 6 ways to Senate. They got as far away from it as they could, and you do not hear any longer on Fox News, the memo coming down from Roger Ailes, you do not hear the talking point of, well, you know, if the Democrats get into office, they're going to impeach Bush. Because they are now afraid that if they keep reciting that, that people will vote Democratic just to get Bush impeached. So what are some of the reasons for impeachment? Dave Lindorf wrote a great guest contribution over at BuzzFlash.com. He points out, first of all, that Democrats avoiding discussing this topic is a cowardly thing to do. I agree. And then he lists the high crimes and misdemeanors, the grave offenses against the Constitution and against the people of the United States committed by George W. Bush, any one of which is worthy of impeachment. And I just want to share this list with you because I think it's important that we periodically revisit the real issues here, the real stuff that's going on. If you're going to do anything about this, if we are collectively as a people going to do anything about the loss of democracy in the United States, the coup d'etat that has taken place, the theft of at least the last three elections, 2000, 2002, 2004, we have to know what the crimes are that are being committed. Number one, this is from David Lindorf's piece on BuzzFlash. Number one, Bush has initiated a war of aggression against a nation that posed no immediate threat to the United States, a war that has needlessly killed 2,500 Americans and maimed and damaged over 20,000 more Americans while killing between 50 and 100,000 innocent Iraqi men, women, and children. Number two, they lied and they organized a conspiracy, a criminal conspiracy to trick the American people and the U.S. Congress into approving an unnecessary and illegal war. Article 3 of a bill of impeachment would be about approving and encouraging, in violation of both United States laws and international laws, and I would add the standards of human decency and international norms of behavior, the use of torture, kidnapping, and so-called rendition of prisoners of war captured in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I would add, captured walking down the street of other cities, as has now been well documented in the course of this so-called war on terror. item of impeachment number 4. They have illegally, the Bush administration, and this is why it needs to be both Bush and Cheney, who are both impeached. And we could throw Condi Rice into that bunch if you can impeach a Secretary of State, and I'm pretty sure you can. They have illegally stripped the, we should toss Gonzalez into this as well, illegally stripped, and then let's get Death Squad John Negroponte in there too, illegally stripped the right of citizenship and the protections of the Constitution from American citizens, denying them the fundamental right to have their cases heard in a court, to hear the charges against them, to be judged in a public court by a jury of their peers, and to have access to an attorney. These are our core rights that are guaranteed in the Constitution of the United States, and that this country, with two horribly embarrassing exceptions, has consistently followed since its founding. Well, arguably three exceptions. The first exception being, of course, the status of African Americans in America in the United States throughout most of our history. A shameful episode in America's past, but to some extent is still continuing and needs to be remedied. Secondly, Franklin Roosevelt interning Japanese Americans during World War II, a shameful and embarrassing incident in American history. And number three, Abraham Lincoln suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War, which you could actually argue, since it was a Civil War, a very different circumstance, he may have been able to figure out a way to justify, or may have, you know, in retrospect, may have been the right thing to do. But certainly not now. Not this. Item of impeachment number 5. Authorizing the spying on American citizens and their communications by the United States National Security Agency and other U.S. police and intelligence agencies in violations of the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, and in violation, direct violation, of a law passed by Congress after Richard Nixon did something very similar, that law being the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. Item number 6 in a bill of impeachment. They have criminally conspired to obstruct investigations into and knowingly covered up knowledge of the deliberate exposing of the identity of a U.S. CIA undercover operative, and may have conspired in the initial outing itself. Number 7, they have obstructed the investigation into the 9/11 attacks and have lied to investigators from Congress and the bipartisan 9/11 Commission, actions that come perilously close to treason. Number 8, they are violating the due process and other constitutional rights of thousands of citizens and legal residents by rounding them up and disappearing them or deporting them without hearings. We're talking about citizens and legal residents being disappeared. The ninth in the list of impeachable offenses, any one of these, would have been sufficient to impeach a president. Number 9, the abuse of power, undermining of the Constitution and violating the presidential oath of office by deliberately refusing to administer over 750 laws duly passed into law by the Congress. Actions which, if left unchallenged, would make the Congress a vestigial body and the president a dictator. 750 laws now that George Bush has said, oh, those don't apply to me. And that's just what we know about. Number 10, criminal negligence of this administration in failing to provide American troops with adequate armor before sending them into a war of choice. Criminal negligence in going to war against a weak third world nation without any planning for post-war occupation and reconstruction. Criminal negligence in failing to respond to a known and growing crisis in the storm-blasted city of New Orleans. And criminal negligence in failing to act, and in fact in actively obstructing efforts by other countries and American state governments to deal with the looming crisis of global warming. A series of acts of criminal negligence on the part of this administration. I would add to that criminal negligence in failing to investigate all the many warnings that were being given to the Bush administration in the months leading up to 9/11, including the warnings given to George Bush personally by Bill Clinton, to Dick Cheney personally by Al Gore, and to Condoleezza Rice personally by Sandy Berger, that Al-Qaeda was coming. Criminal negligence in George W. Bush getting a memo on August 6, 2001 that says Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States, and patting the briefer on the head basically and saying, okay, now you've covered your butt. You know, thanks a lot. I'm going fishing. If this doesn't qualify as criminal negligence, I don't know what does. Failing to protect the United States from a plot that was growing in the United States and about which we had plenty of knowledge. The Bush administration ignored over 50 specific warnings. Over 50 specific warnings. After the break, is the U.S. ready for the next wave of unemployable veterans? Larry Scott, a VA watchdog, will fill us in. 16 minutes past the hour. Truth in broadcasting for a change. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I went out walking through streets paved with gold. Lifted some stones, saw the skin and bones of a city without a soul. I went out walking under an atomic sky. Ground won't turn and the rain it burns like the tears when I said goodbye. Yeah, I went with nothing but the thought of you.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Oh, Johnny Cash, what a boy. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Scott is with us with VAWatchdog.org, the Big Cheese, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer, Senior Editor, and all things wise. Over
all of the above. I like that. And by the way, one of these days you and I will talk about the Johnny Cash show I emceed years ago back in New York State.
You emceed a show for Johnny Cash?
It is. It's an incredible story. I'll tell you about it sometime.
But oh, man.
Let's talk veterans.
That must have been an amazing experience. Yeah, let's talk veterans. VAWatchdog.org, the organization that Larry Scott runs. From Vancouver, Washington, but it's in one of the finest national organizations for veterans. And you have some headline news here, Larry.
There really is some great news for veterans. Well, actually, there's kind of, I feel like Mel Brooks coming down from the mountain with the tablets of stone. You know, I've got good news and I've got bad news. What the good news is, the VA has announced today, Secretary Jim Nicholson announced there will be a free, absolutely free credit monitoring program for veterans who feel that their personal data has been compromised. The bad news is it's going to take at least 2 to 2.5 months to implement this whole thing. But it was announced today that Secretary Nicholson is opening up 4 bids for the credit monitoring organizations. They will be bidding to the VA. And obviously the lowest possible bidder, this is the government, is going to get this contract. They expect to have that lined up by about mid-August, and by mid-August start sending out letters to veterans again. Every veteran who's received the initial letter that most of them got a couple of weeks ago that said, oops, we lost the laptop, will receive a second letter, and it will detail this free credit monitoring program. It will probably be about the 1st of September before you will be able to get into the program. I should let veterans know, this is an opt-in program. There is absolutely nothing automatic about it. You are going to have to sign up. There will be no cost for 1 year. You will have to sign up for this program, but you will get free credit monitoring for a year. It's just going to take about 2 to 2.5 months to get it implemented.
Now, Larry Scott, if I was the head of Equifax or ChoicePoint or, you know, one of these other credit monitoring services, my bid to the government would be free.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do it for free.
Right.
All I want is to be able to have those veterans' that information, because you have to get the information from them in order to be able to give them their information, and to have their credit card numbers so that after 1 year of free credit monitoring, it will roll over to a discounted rate of, say, $29.95 a year.
You know, and that could be what we might be looking at in this, that you'll get a free year if you agree to some type of a contract. I'm not sure. We're not going to know till that comes down. And even if you didn't have to agree to a contract up front, you would have a year of credit monitoring service. Most people, I hope, if the company did it right, would be happy with that service. And then Equifax or whoever would be able to come back and say, you know, now that we've served you for a year, would you like to continue with this program
low
price up?
They don't even do it that way. I mean, if you go over to freecreditreports.com, you know, there's this service that they hype like crazy, and they actually have, like, you know, PSAs saying you can get a free credit. Well, you go over there, and to get your free credit report, you have to give them your credit card. And at the end of a month, I believe it's a month, I'd have to get, you know, it's been a year since I got suckered into the thing and I backed out. At the end of a month, if you don't call them up and say, take me off the list, and you have to, and I did, by the way, and I sat on hold for the better part of 20 minutes trying to get to a human being who I could say, take me off the list. And then he tried three different ways to Sunday to talk me out of taking my name off the list. If you don't call them up and go out of your way to take you off the list, they start automatically billing you for a credit monitoring service.
Yeah, we're going around with our bank on a situation like that now, these opt-out programs. By the way, we're providing you with all these wonderful services. If you want to, you know, these will automatically be continued, but it's going to cost you more per month.
Right.
If you want to opt out, call the toll-free. Do you think you can get through to that toll-free number?
Right.
It's
it's not even that. Even if you can get through, most people just don't get around to it.
Right. Well, that's,
it's called breakage. I mean, these are businesses that make their money on breakage.
It's kind of like the rebate thing. Why do people offer rebates on merchandise? Because only about 15 to 20% of people actually go to the trouble of sending in the rebate.
Yeah.
But we'll be keeping a very close eye on this program. And if there are any wrinkles like this, believe me, we'll be sure to let you know straight away.
Okay, we just have a few seconds left. Yeah. Any other headlines?
Yes, as a matter of fact, a very interesting thing. The five major veteran service organizations have done what we thought was impossible. The American Legion, the VFW, the Disabled American Veterans, the AMVETS, and the Paralyzed Veterans have all joined hands for the first time ever. They have formed Veterans Coalition, Inc. This represents over 7 million living American veterans. That's about one-third of all veterans. This is a marvelous move for veterans. The first thing is forming a commission to study veterans' needs and benefits that they'll be able to take right to the White House and Congress.
That's absolutely great.
It's great.
And you can read all about it at VAWatchdog.org. Larry Scott, the chief cook and bottle washer over there. Larry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you again, Tom.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, where we dare to ask the questions the mainstream media is afraid of.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE. You're listening to True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman program. Chevron on Sunday, the CEO, David O'Reilly, of Chevron shows up on Meet the Press, Tim Russert's program, going, we're all in favor of alternatives to fossil fuels. We're promoting alternatives. Most of our companies are involved in this. I know we are, says David O'Reilly of Chevron. Shell, the CEO of Shell, John Hoffmeister, he says, there's so much we can do in this country. Alternatives, wind, solar, biofuels, hydrogen. Well, California decided to take them at their word. There's a ballot initiative. It's called the Clean Alternative Energy Initiative, and it's actually an initiative that is what it's named. It would impose a wellhead tax on oil companies operating in California. In other words, California is basically going to say, if you're pumping our oil out of our ground, you're going to pay a small tax on that, and that tax is going to be used toward research on alternative fuel vehicles and renewable energy and conservation. And guess who has donated $3,740,000 to produce a statewide PR blitz to get people not to vote for the Clean Alternative Energy Initiative in November? Well, if you guessed Chevron, you guessed right. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jeff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. First of all, I wanted to say that impeachment is too good for George W. Bush. He should be charged with 2,500 counts of criminal homicide. But what I really wanted to talk about was the alcohol in vehicles. Now, I know quite a bit about running alcohol in a vehicle from my experience with drag racing. In drag racing, they use methanol, not ethanol. And I know that's what they make out of the corn in that, the ethanol.
Right.
But the thing from drag racing, I know this. For gasoline, you have a certain ratio when you run gasoline to air. It's like 8-1. And I believe with alcohol, it's like 15-1. So what that means is you have to run much more fuel through the jet. You have to use much larger jets for it to run. And I know this. They said on drag racing motorcycles, if guys would switch from gasoline to alcohol, they would often have to put a larger gas tank on their drag bike simply because the fuel tank that they used for gasoline would not hold enough alcohol. And also, I've heard that...
Well, first of all, do you know if... I can't speak authoritatively to this, and David has left the room. I know that he's driving a Ford pickup truck that is running on pure alcohol, and, you know, just with a very minor modification, and he claims he's getting better gasoline mileage than gasoline. Ethanol is a fairly small molecule. Methanol is I believe, a larger molecule. Are you sure that what you're talking about might not be true of methanol and not ethanol?
Yes, there's a difference. I'm not exactly sure. They're both alcohols, but I'm not sure that...
Oh, there's a lot of things. I mean, there's dozens of things that are alcohols. Yeah. You know, but ethanol is, I think it's the simplest of the alcohols.
Okay.
I could be wrong, and I'm not sure, frankly, why drag racing uses methanol instead of ethanol. Unless it's that they don't want people to drink the stuff coming out of the hose.
It could be that.
I just don't know.
I know this, too. Alcohol is much more corrosive than gasoline. It'll cause, if you try to run it like that old gasohol they had years ago,
that
in an older vehicle, it would loosen the scale up that was in the gas tank.
Well, here's the problem. It's not that it's corrosive. It's that it's a better solvent.
Okay.
And if you've never had... And this is the problem that David was pointing out, is that regular gasoline is a toxic waste dumping ground. What regular gasoline has in it some 400 different chemicals, only about 10% of which are actually necessary to burn in your car. The rest of them are there because it's leftover stuff that the oil companies can't sell, and it will, in fact, burn. So they're basically, gasoline is mostly toxic waste, or largely toxic waste. And as a consequence of that, there's things like the varnishes in there. I mean, they're very low fraction stuff, very, you know, relatively insoluble stuff, and they coat up the inside of your fuel lines and all that kind of stuff. You put alcohol in there, alcohol is a very efficient solvent, it'll dissolve those things. But in terms of the hoses and the fittings and the pipes and all that kind of thing, it's not at all corrosive, and because it doesn't gum things up and clog things up and crud things up, and the long carbon chains that form don't, you know, eventually break down and reduce friction, increase wear, then the lifespan of an engine with alcohol in it is three times longer than a lifespan of an engine with gasoline in it.
I know this. A drag race motor running on alcohol will run cooler than a motor running on gasoline. But I've heard some people say that an engine running on alcohol actually puts out worse pollutants into the air.
No.
No.
It doesn't put out any pollutants because you're basically ethanol anyway. I don't know what's in methanol. I don't know what causes that M to be there. But ethanol is, you know, just, it's basically a very large and funky sugar molecule, if I'm remembering my organic chemistry right.
Okay.
You have carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen in it. And the carbon combines with oxygen to form carbon dioxide, and the hydrogen forms with oxygen to form water vapor. And those are the two things that come out of the tailpipe, period.
Okay.
Whereas with alcohol, with gasoline, you've got 400 different chemicals in there. You've got heavy metals ranging from mercury to lead. You've got it's just a toxic soup.
Tom, we have to get away from gasoline. I know that. I just don't know if ethanol is the answer. These hydrogen fuel cells may be the answer. Now, I know you have a very knowledgeable audience. Perhaps somebody could call in and tell us exactly the difference between methanol and ethanol. They're both alcohols, but they're different.
Sure. And in fact, my guess is that somebody in the chat room is on it right now, and we'll be tracking it down. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. calling for raising the issue. We'll continue to pursue this. Yeah, thanks a lot. Mike in Juneau, Alaska. Hey, Mike.
Hey,
listening
Tom.
On KUDO, our favorite Alaskan station. What's up, Mike?
I am actually a podcaster, so I'm a little
cliche
behind you, but not only are you great, but you are getting better every day.
Well, thank you, Mike. I hope you are, too.
I am. I would like to urge all Alaskans to contact Senator Stevens' office today as chair of the Commerce Committee. He has significant influence over the proceedings and bills, which net neutrality is scheduled for a vote tomorrow, I believe.
That's right.
Urge his office to support the Snowdrogan version and to drop his amendments because his amendments, as they are, don't bar the telcos from discriminating behavior with website traffic.
Yeah, and let's point out to our listeners in Alaska that it would be Ted Stevens. Well, actually, pretty much anywhere you can call Ted Stevens, but in Alaska, you have the special privilege of actually having an Alaska zip code, which will cause his office to pay much more attention to your call. And the toll-free number for Congress that anybody can call from anywhere in the United States, toll-free, 1-888-888-355-3588. Or if you have free long distance and you want to call the regular number right into the switchboard, the number is 202-225-3121, 225-3121. And those numbers, both of those numbers, by the way, are on my homepage at tomhartman.com. At the last, they're at the end of a line of bulleted items right on our homepage. Just tomhartman.com will get you there.
Yeah, and any bill that they pass should include a provision that maintains neutrality but bars telcos or the FCC or anybody from restricting speeds. As you've mentioned, they already charge based on bandwidth usage.
Yeah, we want to leave the last bastion of democracy in our media, in our communication systems, the Internet. We want to leave it at least semi-democratic. It's okay to charge to get into it. It's okay to charge to get out of it. But selectively charging based on the origin of data, that's something that's a road we don't want to go down, because then we're going to end up with an Internet that is essentially really works well for very large companies that pay the fees and really doesn't work well for everybody else.
I believe there's a hidden agenda that I don't think you talked about on Monday when you did your net neutrality section. But really the Internet's about the flow of information. And if the neocons can corporatize Internet information the way they've done it with TV and then applying that censorship or self-censorship that you get even with CNN,
yep,
then it's not a stretch to realize that they've already flexed their muscle with the NSA phone record scandal, the forced firing of Dan Rather, their right-wing CBS CEO, and stuff like that. Through the use of lucrative government contracts as a coercive tool, they can influence AT&T, Verizon, and other telcos.
Well, these companies, I mean, they have their own political agenda anyway. At its core, the conservative agenda is a corporatist agenda. And so when the corporations take over the Internet, guess whose agenda is going to be promoted? This is one of the reasons why I'm getting emails constantly from right-wing websites and conservative members of Congress saying, oh, you don't want government having control over the Internet, do you? Which is a fancy way of saying, well, then let's give control of the Internet over to the corporations, over to AT&T. It's the exact same argument that was used against national health care when Bill and Hillary proposed it. They said, oh, you don't want the government telling you what doctor you go to, do you? And nobody raised the other half of the question. Oh, would you rather have a health insurance company tell you which doctor you can go to? Because those are your choices, ultimately. Mike, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Hey, Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. What's up, Gary?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Now you talk about the Internet. Just bring me, that's why I've always had this gut feeling. Internet, on balance, will be a net minus for America. That's the way I feel. I think right now it's approaching that.
Because?
Well, you can articulate better than I can. I really called, and maybe you want to throw some thoughts out there on it. I really believe it's a net minus in the long run, but time will tell. I hope not, but time will tell. I'm talking about the minimum wage. Are we too cheap in America? Are we too cheap in America to provide a little pittance, an increase in the minimum wage for some of our hardest workers in America?
No, we in America are not. 70-80% of Americans are in favor of raising the minimum wage. The conservatives who control the House, the Senate, and the White House are too cheap.
Right. Well,
that's right. I mean, that's the simple answer, Gary. That's just what the thing boils down to, is the conservatives are too cheap. And you're absolutely right. That is the context in which this issue should be framed. And thank you very much for calling and bringing it up. You know, are we too cheap to take care of people who work 40 hours a week, they put in their time, they pay their dues to society, and they can't make a decent living? What's wrong with this picture? 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah.
the Tom Hartman Program.
Starting to say our climate's in a warm and trend. And if we keep cutting down the forests, we will surely meet our end. We should do business in an eco-friendly way. But that would cost too much, so all I've got to say is come on, come on, come on, come on.
Flush it!
Flush another little piece of the forest, baby.
Burn it!
Burn another little piece of Brazil, it feels so good.
Cut it!
Cut another little piece of the forest down, baby.
Welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here, where we run rings around the right wing 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. A great discussion going on in the chat room about methanol and ethanol and some of the questions raised by our last caller. Ethanol is C2, two atoms of carbon, H5, 5 hydrogen, and OH, C2H5OH, whereas methanol is CH3OH. So, if I recall right, that means that there are three carbon atoms in a molecule of methanol and two in ethanol. More hydrogen in the ethanol than in methanol. Now, I'm not sure what that means in terms of its ability to release energy. I would suspect more hydrogen would mean more energy potential, but I frankly don't know. Anyhow, Robert Bob says, Tom, methanol is used to achieve high power over short periods of time. It was used in World War II to boost the power of the supercharged piston engine, the P-51 Mustang, and the Merlin engine. Marion Delgado in the chat room says, methanol is a poison and ethanol is not. Right, ethanol is what you drink in alcoholic beverages. Methanol is the stuff that would creep into moonshine and make people go blind. T. Jean says, as a smaller molecule, methanol vaporizes at a lower temperature. Coach Glenn says, methanol is a wood alcohol, while ethanol is a grain alcohol. He says, the difference between pure methanol and the 10% mix of ethanol dropped engine power from 675 horsepower to 610 horsepower. That's interesting. Are you for compulsory pregnancy? These are screen names in the chat room. You can get to the chat room by going to tomhartman.com, by the way, and just click live chat. It says, says methanol from natural gas is much cheaper than ethanol. Methanol from wood, corn, trash, etc. is potentially much cheaper than ethanol from corn, but requires gasification, compression, and a catalyst. We built a gasifier at NREL in the 1980s and produced 1 gallon of methanol at great expense. Marion Delgado says it's now produced synthetically by the direct combination of hydrogen and carbon monoxide gases heated under pressure in the presence of a catalyst. Methanol meaning that. Can Channel Cassandra says, I love the topic, Tom. Okay, I appreciate that. Marion Delgado says, that volume of air might be a problem. Coach Glenn from the Speed TV chat, he says, the IRL is using is using a 90% methanol, 10% ethanol blend this year, but they're going to 100% ethanol next year. And he says, it's also my understanding that the methanol produced in this country is from non-renewable sources. Steve in Albany, New York on the line. Steve, you know the difference between ethanol and methanol.
Yes, I do. I have a master's in chemistry, and the methanol is a single carbon. You just read off the formula for it, CH3OH. The OH is the alcohol group. There's three hydrogens and one carbon.
I see.
Ethanol has two carbon. It's a two-carbon chain with the alcohol group.
Right.
Propanol, which would be the next one, it has a three-carbon chain.
Mm-hmm.
And so the methanol is actually the simpler alcohol. And it actually, because it's smaller, there's less chemical bonds, has less energy in it.
Ah, interesting. So ethanol would produce better gas mileage, presumably, in a car because it has more stored-up energy, shall we say.
Exactly. The more chemical bonds you have, that's what burns. When you actually burn something, you're just breaking chemical bonds and releasing that energy.
Right, the energy that was originally For example, with photosynthesis, they take the energy of the sun, and that energy is then used, is basically bound up. It's used to combine a couple of atoms together into a more complex molecule.
Yeah,
and
photosynthesis, the plant converts, is actually making sugars.
Right, out of water and oxygen and sunlight.
Exactly,
using energy
and
sunlight
nutrients that are brought up from the ground.
Right, yeah.
And so when you're actually burning something, it's the reverse process. You're releasing that energy.
Right.
And
when
you burn an alcohol, you're actually going to have it, whether it's methanol or ethanol or propanol or any of them, you're going to have principally a carbon dioxide and water vapor.
Now, one of the folks in our chat room asked the question, and Steve, this is so cool. Somebody with a master's degree in chemistry calling, asked the question, why, if you're burning anything, frankly, including an alcohol, which is basically just carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, which would presumably only have as its waste products carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide, the various carbon oxides and water, what about the fact that you're burning it in the presence of nitrogen? Do you produce nitrogen oxides?
Well, it's possible because you've got the heat and the oxygen there.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, part of the reason why you produce what are called the NOxes, the nitrogen oxides,
right,
when you're burning gasoline is because there's nitrogen in the gas.
Ah, so it's not the nitrogen in the air, because our atmosphere is like, what, 70% nitrogen, something like that?
Right, right. And yeah. Nitrogen itself is pretty inert.
Yeah, that was my thought, was that nitrogen, yes, I said in the chat room. I thought nitrogen was inert.
And I think one of the problems with the conservative groups is that, like Stephen Colbert says, they want to debate facts.
Yeah, there you go. Steve in Albany, New York, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to the program. Coming up on tomorrow's program, on your Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, Cass Ingram says uranium oxide in the air is causing severe health effects. Steve Freeman and Joel Blyfus are dropping by, and their new book was The 2004 Presidential Election Stolen. That and more in your calls right here on the Democracy Zone, the Tom Hartman program. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.